This is Joanna Schrader reporting for DomesticFuel.com. And this afternoon, I am with Monty Shaw, the Executive Director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. Monty, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Well, you know, your conference was about 6 weeks ago, and yet you have not slowed down at all, Monty. I got an email, which I'm so excited about, that you are hosting a Century of Biofuel or Century of Subsidies birthday party for Big Oil on Thursday. Tell us about this.
Well, that's right. IRFA is teaming up with ACE, the American Coalition for Ethanol. They have an annual fly-in to D.C. to lobby Congress, and we decided it would be a great time to throw a birthday party because the oldest continuous oil subsidies, it's specific for the oil industry, was enacted in 1913. And so it dawned on us a few months ago that this is, in fact, the 100th birthday of oil subsidies, and that calls for a party. And I think people can assume that our tongues are firmly planted in our cheeks when we say that we're going to celebrate that fact.
So, Monty, as part of this party, are we celebrating subsidies for renewable fuel, or am I correct in saying renewable fuels have none?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the ethanol tax break that went to the corn ethanol blender, ironically, it went to the oil companies too, if they blended ethanol, but even when it went to the oil companies for using ethanol did expire at the end of 2011. So, little old ethanol somehow manages to get by without it, but the 100-year-old oil industry, the most profitable industry in the history of the world, still needs that taxpayer crush to get by. The way they tell it. So, you know, and to be fair, we're not even going to make the case that all of these, and there's several, I mean, the oldest one goes back to 1913, but there are lots of others. We're not even going to make the case on Thursday that they should all go away. You know what? Maybe in a thoughtful debate, there's one here or one there that makes some sense for national security, something, I don't know. What we're saying, though, is they're there. And we're sick and tired of people in Congress who either don't know any better or who don't want to know any better saying, oh, why do you need the RFS? Why do you need this? Why do you need that? Can't you just compete on a level playing field? When the fact of the matter is our competition has had 100 years of subsidization. They've now had nearly 40 years of a petroleum mandate written into federal law that says unless you drive a flexible fuel vehicle, you will purchase a gasoline with a minimum amount of petroleum, and that minimum amount is now 85% petroleum. That's a mandate. That's crazy. And they've also got all kinds of other things from loan guarantees on pipelines to preferential tax structures like master limited partnerships that the rest of us can't use. The playing field is overwhelmingly tilted in Big Oil's favor, and that has got to be a part of any discussion on the RFS.
Well, Montina, let's talk for a minute. Last week, the big news out of Washington, D.C. was sequestration and budget cuts. And the parties were refusing, I believe it was the Republican Party, was refusing to end subsidies and close tax loopholes. So how is it that Big Oil has managed to keep this intact in a country that can't balance its budget?
Well, you know, you'd have to ask them that. They're a pretty powerful group. I mean, you know, it's a real David and Goliath story, and you know, I'm under no illusions that this year Congress is going to pass a law that takes away all of these tax credits and subsidies and preferential treatments and quite frankly mandates for petroleum. It might be good public policy, it might be good policy, it might be good energy security and economic development and environmental policy, but the oil companies have a lot of friends. They've bought and paid for a lot of friends in Congress. And so what we're going to try to do, though, is to say, knowing that all this stuff for Big Oil is here, the subsidies, the mandates, the preferential treatments, knowing it's there, the RFS is the only policy on the books that actually promotes competition at the pump, mm-hmm. that actually kicks the door open of the petroleum mandate to give a consumer some choices that are just petroleum, 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 petroleum. And so we're going to very forcefully make the case that that some of the same people who want to protect those tax subsidies for the oil industry are going to be pretty hypocritical if they want to come after the RFS and call it a mandate or call it special treatment or something like that. Whether your parents used to teach you when you're little to try to teach you good manners, they said, now when you point at somebody, there's one finger at them, but there's about four fingers pointing back at you. or three fingers and a thumb, however that works. Anyway, that's kind of what we're going to do to some of these politicians in the oil industry that want to go, oh, look what the renewables get. Oh, look at the RFS. Oh, look at this. Look at this. They might be pointing one finger at us, but they've got three fingers and a thumb pointing back at them. And we're going to make sure that everybody knows it. It's called hypocrisy, by the way, just to save people the trouble of looking it up.
So, Monty, for a comparison, as you aptly point out, as of this year, oil has been receiving subsidies for 100 years. And you also pointed out that the ethanol industry's subsidies went away after 2011. So on a comparative basis, how long was the ethanol industry receiving subsidies?
The first tax credit, and again, I want to be very clear, the ethanol tax credit did not go to ethanol producers. Now, I'm not saying it didn't benefit the sale of ethanol. It did. It made ethanol more attractive to the oil companies. But remember, this is how good the oil companies are. Even the ethanol tax credit went to the oil companies. It went to the blender. That was the oil companies. It was a blender's tax credit. That was enacted in 1978 and was extended a few different times at different levels and then expired in 2011. So you would have had basically the 80s, the 90s, just over 30 years, I don't know, 32 years, something like that. And we managed to grow up and get our feet underneath us and truck right on down the road. And yet the oil industry isn't quite there yet. They still need that taxpayer-funded crutch, apparently. So it's pretty amazing if you think about it.
So the ethanol industry, in fact, grew up in about 40 years, whereas the ethanol industry is 100 and they still haven't grown up.
Yeah, the oil industry's got 100. Well, and let's be honest, we know they've grown up, but they're making billions of dollars a year off these tax credits. They don't need them. They just like them. And I get that. Hey, you know, if you said, Monty, I want to take away 5% of your salary, I wouldn't necessarily jump up and down and yell whoopee. But the fact of the matter is these are funded by the taxpayers. When we have a huge debt problem, the industry is very mature, very profitable, and yet they cling to them because they can. It's the epitome, in most cases, of bad public policy. But even then, I want to stress, we're not going there on Thursday to say get rid of all of them, mm-hmm. because we know that that's, you know, probably not going to happen given all the friends that they've, shall we say, supported in Congress. So, you know, all we're saying is, hey, let's not ignore the fact that the oil industry is highly subsidized, that it's got a mandated product, that it has loan guarantees for its infrastructure that we don't have. It's got it's got preferential tax structures that its businesses can use that we can't. It's got a distribution monopoly. It's got all of these things. And so if they want to come after the RFS and talk about a level playing field, then game on, because they've got quite a bit of history that they're trying to get people to ignore there.
So, Monty, you know, to wrap up, let's talk a minute about the renewable fuel standard. How much is the renewable fuel standard costing taxpayers?
Well, it doesn't cost taxpayers anything. It's a minimum blending requirement for the oil companies. So there's no tax preferential tax treatment or credits or anything like that. It has no budget impact.
Well, I think that's a good point to make while you're out there, too.
All right, I'm going to add that to my talking points.
Add it to your talking points, Monty. Or
what it really does, if you want to look at the consumers, is it forces the oil companies to crack the door open to E10. I mean, without the RFS, E10 would probably not be selling coast to coast, and it's cheaper than gas everywhere in the country. And now we're working on E15, which is another, at least in Iowa, another 4 to 5 cents a gallon cheaper than E10. And the oil companies hate it, and they're doing everything they can to stop it. And it's only by keeping the RFS that they'll be forced to put that choice. It's not a requirement. It's not a mandate. But to put the option of E15 in front of consumers. So consumers can make up their own minds. Do I want that all petroleum product? Do I want that 10% product? Or do I want to save another nickel and buy E15? All we want to do is get some products in front of consumers because we're cheaper, we're cleaner, and we're higher. We'll do just fine if we have a level playing field.
Great. Well, Monty, I will see you out in D.C. for the press conference.
Okay, bye.
Bye.